Hey folks, Jeff Salzman here, and welcome to, I guess, what we might call season three of the Integral Living Room, the community calls, and also the event that we hold at the Integral Center. We've done two of them so far, one at the end of last year in October, November of last year, and we did one over the Memorial Day weekend. It's a Friday through Sunday affair where people come together from all over the place and just hang out at the Boulder Integral Center in the Integral Living Room, which is what is the inspiration around it. The next Integral Living Room that we've just announced is October 9th through 12th, so coming up in about 3 months. And we're really excited about it. And by we, I mean Terry Patton, my partner, and Diane Hamilton, my partner. And the three of us have been working together for, gosh, almost, I think, over 10 years, producing Integral events and seminars and so forth. We've worked with Ken Wilber. Ken Wilber is part of the Integral Living Room. He shows up for an afternoon, one of the days. This time it'll be on Saturday. And Ken also joins us on the calls. We record a call with Ken before most of the calls we do, and we do these community calls monthly. And we have an excerpt, generally, that we play on these live calls of us talking to Ken, and tonight we have an excerpt. And so it'll really be the four of us, plus you, and it's good to see so many people signed on to the call tonight. So I will just bid again a warm hello. I'm coming to you from beautiful Boulder, Colorado, where it's just a sort of a balmy night and maybe a little shower coming, and it's good to be with you. And let me introduce my partners on the call. First of all, Terry Patton.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Well, I'm excited about our call tonight. I think we're doing something really exciting here with bringing in something from popular culture that is thoughtful and current and drawing an integral perspective on the kind of advanced views of big thinking. So I'm excited about this. I'm really turned on by a lot of the things that came out in our call with Ken that we're going to be playing an excerpt from. So I'm just stoked about what we're doing, and I'm delighted to be digging in to work with the two of you again and our community, because there's something really joyous about the quality of intelligence, awakening, emotional availability, rawness, insight, courage, and tenderness that we all share when we gather in this community in person or even on the phone. So I'm really happy to be back. Thanks for bringing me in, Jeff.
Yeah, and it's just so that the purpose of the living room is to be just that, a place where people who are sort of self-identified as evolutionaries, as flying at an integral altitude, at least on good days, get together with other people who are also self-identified. And there's something that's very powerful about being with people who see the world and get the world and really basically have the same receptors that you do. And so the living room is really based around that we space, that we use conversation as our practice and take it very seriously and really work at the best practices of, as we say, creating the best conversations of your life. And what we're going to do this time in October coming up, the event 9th through 12th and the monthly calls leading up to that, we're going to be talking about the series Cosmos, the astronomy life science series by Neil deGrasse Tyson, which is an update of the Carl Sagan series. And so, Diane, would you like to say hello and contextualize what we're doing this in this living room with our topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome to the call, everybody. I'm really happy to be on the line with Jeff and Terry, and thank you to Brett Walker and Julia Satti for doing the technical backup on this call. There are about 100 people who are on the line who are listening, and The living room is really born when we talk. Jeff, Terry, and I were talking about what is it that we appreciate about the Integral community. We feel like we have the best conversations because there's so much fluidity in terms of people being able to access their first person perspective, to do spiritual practice, or to talk about psychology, and then a lot of sophistication in the second person in culture and relationship, and then when we move to the third person, it's such a diverse community, and there's so many really, you know, very accomplished professionals in all sorts of vocations and, you know, areas of interest. So what's so wonderful is that we can move, you know, we consider the Integral Living Room a community of practice because we do meditation and we do first-person perspectives and we do practice working with conflict and listening. But we thought it would be really exciting to actually focus on this Cosmos series, which is right now has the, you know, is quite popular, as you know, on mainstream television. So basically what we're going to do this tonight is we're going to be focusing on episode 3. And in this episode, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was really the lineage successor of Carl Sagan, he describes, he goes into this whole issue around how the human capacity for pattern recognition and how it manifested early in astronomy and in other proto-sciences, and how it's developed as a capacity in consciousness to engage with whatever the object of our awareness is. In this case, you know, what is out there, what is in the third person. And so we're going to be focusing on pattern recognition. And what's going to be interesting is that Ken is actually going to talk to us a little bit about the dichotomy of true-false pattern recognition and the way in which when one set of patterns emerges, that it displaces the earlier set of pattern recognition until integral consciousness gets to a level where it actually can see the truth in earlier forms of patterns, and it doesn't necessarily become an either-or, but it becomes a both-and. So we're going to take some time with that. He'll talk to us a little bit about recognizing Isaac Newton for the genius he is and, you know, the integral identity in relationship to evolving truths, because we're really going to be talking about evolving truths this evening as well as pattern recognition. So with that, thank you everyone for being on the call. And Brett, by the way, everyone, the clip, you'll be listening to Ken talk about this particular episode for a total of about 27 minutes. So find a comfortable place to listen and enjoy.
What we're getting here is the fact that with evolution, it's like Hegel said, each stage is adequate, each higher stage is more adequate. So we have to come up with something essentially similar, that each stage is true as long as it's actually reporting the way that level looks. And so all of that magical interpretation of comments, that wasn't false pattern recognition. That was an accurate recognition of the magic structure of consciousness. So we have this notion of a sliding truth, that what's adequate at one level, at next level, it's more adequate. What's true at one level, next level, it's more true. Next level is more true, but it's still true. It's just we're getting more and more adequate views as we go along. But that's not to take away the relative truth that each level has. Because if not, like I said, what we call truth today will be false pattern recognition, or not really true, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now. And so humanity will never have truth. And that's essentially what he says. When he says, oh, no, all of a sudden Newton got it right, everybody else got it wrong.
We get to encounter Isaac Newton, which I'm really, really appreciative that he presented this view of who this great luminary was, and now we get to experience him in the lineage of human awakening.
Right.
It's not simply spiritual awakening. Isaac Newton now gets to be on my altar as one of the great, you know, awakened beings. And, you know, there's this moment of sadness where he's an alchemist and a mystic, and he works on alchemy, and he works on the secret codes in the Bible to figure out the second coming. And none of that results in anything, but when he works on, you know, the mathematics of the gravitational pull and why the planets orbit in the way they do, he actually ends up with his published book, which Haley supported him in, but I'm devastated on that other side of the street. And is it because he's using the wrong criteria, or is it all just shit missing the path?
Well, that's what's so interesting, is you have to realize that, you know, human beings have multiple intelligences or multiple developmental lines. And we can be at a different level of development in each of those lines. And so when it came to Newton's sort of looking in a kind of third person objective scientific sense, he was clearly at orange or even higher. I mean, he in an era that was predominantly mythic. And what started to happen around the Renaissance is that in some lines, this new, extraordinary capacity for third-person objective, quote, scientific intelligence started to come into play. And that meant that pattern recognition hit an entirely new level. So a third person meant a universal perspective could be taken. And that was a new level of collectively available awareness. Only a handful of people prior to that period in time had reached that capacity. And so with that capacity, you can start developing more universal scientific truths. Age of Enlightenment, the Durants called the Age of Reason and Revolution. And reason could consider alternatives, what if and as if, which means experimental conditions, and then actually check them out. And particularly began measurement. And it was measurement more than anything that marked the founding of the modern sciences. The Greeks classified, as Whitehead said, what they would have learned if they measured. So in 1605, independently, Kepler and Galileo formulated the notion that the laws of nature were to be understood through measurement. Galileo measured earthly motion. Kepler and his teacher Tycho Brahe measured planetary motion. And they both came up with laws governing those motions. And then the genius of Newton, and legend had it, he was, you know, sitting under an apple tree, an apple fell on his head. Now, what he understood is that the force that made the apple fall on his head was the same force that held the moon in orbit around the Earth, and the Earth in orbit around the sun. In other words, gravity. So he pulled together earthly and heavenly laws, and indeed came up with the Principia Mathematica's first statement of universal third-person scientific view of reality. One of the biographies of Newton said, every now and then you run across a genius of such magnitude that you simply don't know how to convey it. And that's what Newton was. He was simply beyond comprehension, the degree of the genius that that guy brought. In the sort of cognitive scientific line, he's third person and is grasping all these universal, objective scientific laws, which is how the world does look at that level. And so atoms at that level were thought of as actually like little planetary systems. There was the nucleus of the atom, which is like the sun, and then in actual orbits around the nucleus were the electrons. And that was thought to be an accurate representation of what the atoms were like. That was there until green emerged, green pluralism. And then the idea was that you actually had multiple subatomic particles. These were called quarks. And there were seven or eight different types, and they were kind of falling all over each other. The Teal holistic emerged, and there started to become a unified quark theory, sometimes called the eightfold way. And then the discovery of the Higgs boson sort of completed that and made that a solidified way to look at it. And then there began a search for a so-called theory of everything, which is a way to unite the four basic forces that physics recognize: strong, weak, nuclear, electromagnetic, and gravitational. And as turquoise began to emerge, that something called string theory, or eventually M theory, started to emerge as well, which is a much more sophisticated and complex view coming from a higher level of cognition. And it could handle that type of unified theory. But it also was such an extraordinarily abstract system of thought that even its proponents acknowledged that there was no way it could ever be empirically tested. So strictly speaking, they weren't dealing with a scientific notion anymore. They were dealing with something that was simply taken on religious faith, basically. It was much more kind of Pythagorean, Platonic view. People were attracted to it because it seemed to work. There was a way that it could pull together all of these other theories. And, of course, that's what evolution does. It keeps striving towards greater and greater wholeness, greater and greater inclusivity, and greater and greater comprehensiveness. And so that becomes one of the marks of the more adequate nature of each higher level of evolution, or the more truth that it contains, is the more whole it is, the greater its integral or integrative or inclusive capacity. And so then looking back on everything previously, none of that appears ultimately real anymore. It all appears some version of false pattern recognition. I mean, people think about atoms as little planetary systems is now hysterical. I mean, it's nothing like that at all. That's no more right than comets indicating bad news.
In a way, the scientific view, as you described it, finding its way to coexist with the religious mythic view that was dominating the public sphere and the definition of truth, needed a way to differentiate the value spheres and to give science a safe space to begin. And the way that Descartes did that was cogito ergo sum, sed dubito ergo sum. And he did that essentially by making his own subjectivity an object of doubt, of consideration, and therefore trying to find an objective place to stand, which was a false subjectivity now seen through a more sophisticated level of pattern recognition. It was limited. And in a way, what has evolved through the work of many people, and certainly all postmodernists participated in that, but what I think has happened with integral theory is you've generated a whole series of important orienting generalizations through which the structures that pattern perspectives themselves can be seen. It arrives us in a process relationship. We are processes in a relationship which is also in process with worlds and others which are also processes, and all of that is something that we're in a dynamic, evolving relationship even to our understanding of. There are several huge leaps, orders of magnitude, of growth in the sophistication of the pattern recognition represented at each of these levels of meaning making, and I would love to hear you elaborate on that.
Well, I appreciate that. These are things, of course, that almost nobody sort of consciously sets out to select in their lives, but. At some point in my late teens, things separated and isolated, divorced and fragmented, just stopped making sense to me almost entirely. And I, looking back on it, probably some sort of initial foray into second tier. And it was interesting that the book Spiral Dynamics, when they're giving examples of turquoise, one of the few actual examples they give of works coming at that level is they specifically mention spectrum of consciousness as an example of turquoise thinking. And of course, I wrote that book when I was 23, and I was attempting to look at all the various things that could be called liberations, whether it was anything with psychoanalysis, Gestalt therapy, Zen, and Vedanta. And what struck me is that they all seemed to disagree with each other. And that was just sort of, it was puzzling, but it was also kind of infuriating. because they all were so clearly claiming that they were on to some sort of truth. And what it finally dawned on me was that if instead of just sort of assuming that consciousness is a single thing that doesn't change that much, but if you actually see it as a really broad developmental spectrum and you include much more than the West was willing to include, so that you could indeed get into transpersonal and unity states and so on, that you then would end up with a basic outline that could allow all these different approaches to have some degree of truth, particularly if they were addressing their own level or their own dimension. And so that was not a conscious choice I made. It was simply the way that this particular being was functioning at that time. And I think it was because it was in a lot of ways poking into the second tier, that a lot of people who had made that transformation and would read my stuff had a kind of immediate recognition. They would go, "Oh, I knew this. This completely makes sense. I could have written this book." And it was that recognition. Because the thing about these actual structures or levels of consciousness is that they're not just ideas, like Jacques Derrida comes up with deconstruction. And you can agree with it or not agree with it. The thing about these fundamental levels of development is that they're real territories. They actually exist. They're not something that you can choose to agree with or choose not to agree with. If you grow and develop, you'll go through them. And so you'll actually be at that territory. And we have people at second tier territory. But there wasn't much that would reflect that stance for them. And, of course, most of the approaches continue to be just one field, one area, one dimension, one level, one line, one state. And this wasn't very satisfying to a lot of people. And so for those people who it wasn't satisfying, then these books meant a lot. And it helped them recognize the territory they were already at. And so it really wasn't so much that I was giving arguments that changed people, is that I was pointing out something that they already knew, but they just didn't have a language for it. They hadn't fully labeled or correctly thought about. And so it was more an immediate sort of recognition process than I gave some brilliant argument and changed their mind. I like to think I came up with some fairly bright arguments, but I don't think that's what attracted people. And so that then, as you start to look at that, it becomes, it's a phrase that Thomas Huxley loved, evolution had become conscious of itself. And that's what started, in a sense, really started with the German idealists and people like Fichte. And this is coming off Immanuel Kant, who's presenting a structure of a mind as if it's fixed. And so he has categories of the understanding, there's 12 of those, and they're there. And Hegel looks at it and says what Fichte, well, he first pointed out. These can only be conceived as structures that have developed. In other words, that it evolved. They weren't always there. And so Fichte said, what we need is a pragmatic history of consciousness. We have an evolutionary understanding of our own awareness. And Schelling, of course, picked that up. And for Schelling, nature is objective spirit, and then it awakens and sleeping. It awakens in mind or subjective spirit, and then mind and nature become unified in non-dual oneness or ultimate spirit itself. Darwin got the idea from them, applied it to biology. Other people started applying it to psychology, anthropology, and so on. And suddenly, we're in an evolutionary world. And so evolution had become conscious of itself. And then looking back on all of the previous eras of humankind's history, almost a million years, there was this understanding either that they just got it all wrong. There was nothing but, you know, false pattern recognition, which is how every level tends to look at every previous level. until you get to second tier, and then they start to actually think the previous levels have something significant, and that's one of the markers of the second tier, more integral awareness. Or you saw the sliding scale that Hegel was talking about, every stage is adequate, every higher stage is more adequate. And that takes a little bit of second tier capacity to be able to get that notion. So that becomes one of the problems, is that these developmental philosophies and psychologies and so on are themselves capable of being only grasped at starting at certain levels. So now you can't just win a philosophical argument by giving the best argument, because different levels will be able to see different things. And if you're the level that can't see whole article transcend and include in several different dimensions simultaneously, then you're not going to get a developmental evolutionary point of view. It doesn't matter how much you argue or what kind of facts or evidence that you present. It's just, as Keegan puts it, over our heads. So that becomes a difficulty. And it's that the higher forms of pattern recognition are only recognizable from higher levels of pattern recognition development. And so now we're in a delicate situation of all of a sudden the person's own interior makeup is part of what they're going to accept as reality. And so that means that every stage of development becomes a station in life and a view of the world that's significantly different than the others. And we've only barely begun to face how to deal with that. So it's only been a couple hundred years, for example, that we've actually tried to make countries based on pluralities. The United States dedicated and conceived the proposition that all men are created equal. We've never created a country based on an idea, a universal idea. Countries are all developed because of certain racial strains that were there. And so Teutonic tribes, Germany, and Franco tribes, France, and so on. But none of them were created based on a idea or a universal notion that was alien to most of humanity's history. And as we continue to grow and evolve, again, 500 years from now, 5,000 years from now, people will look back at us, and we'll just appear silly. So the question now is, given everything that's arising at a leading-ish edge, somewhere around turquoise, integral levels of development, given all the phenomena that can be brought into awareness at that point, what's the best way to look at it? And there are better and worse ways to do that. Scientific materialism, not a good way to do that. Something more, all quadrant, all level, all line, all state, better. It has more truth, more phenomena taken into account, more dimensions taken seriously, more methods, methodologies taken sincerely. And so it's just generically a more comprehensive and a whole framework. And that will hopefully provide, you know, people a fair amount of sense making at this point in their unfolding. And of course, out of those groups of people, you know, several are breaking into even higher or third tier structures, and many of those are getting laid down in a sense for the first time and becoming cosmic habits. They're being passed on by evolution because they're creating these morphogenetic fields.
In the Buddhist tradition, we could talk about dependent origination or dependent arising, that everything to some degree is created by everything else, and there is no, you know, sort of innate selfness because it's all being determined in all four quadrants at every moment. But I think this is really important when we get back to what Terry was talking about, and I think it's important for our event as we do this down the road, is that as we move through these levels, that this first person perspective that can be you know, that we tend to get pretty embedded in,
right.
You know, that we can see with Isaac Newton, that Isaac Newton had this incredible capacity in the third-person perspective, but the program was really interesting in terms of his own first person. He was abandoned. He was alienated. He was in this long-standing dispute with Robert Hooke. You know, he was a person who suffered a lot. And that as an integralist, if we take your advice, Ken, and we bring an integral frame, what is the largest frame that I can bring to this program and appreciate it in the fullest dimension without doing what I do, which is to feel that somehow some part of what I think I understand somehow is wrong. You know, the comets, the way we interpret the comets are wrong. No, they're not wrong. They're limited, or they're defined by the fullest extent of understanding at that moment. So who I am as Diane, who I am as an integralist, how I take in this program is going to depend to some degree on how I understand this I. And this is the thing we want people to get from our integral living room, is not only are we in conversation, but we're also in an inquiry of identity, but the identity that's understanding the integral framework by its very nature is changing precisely because the framework is available, and it's a different way of accessing what we might call enlightened mind than maybe conventional methods, you know. So this capacity to shift my I as part of this understanding, my capacity to shift the we. So once again, Isaac Newton has this big, massively revolutionary third-person perspective, which creates a platform on which the evolution of science stands, and yet he's in this really primitive and sort of sad, you know, dispute with this guy Hooke, and therefore has to like burn his portrait at the end, you know. And the question that an integralist might say is, well, there's, you know, there are partial truths there. What would that dialogue have looked like? And on the other hand, we have Haley, you know, who's sort of his advocate, who kind of cultivates him and, in a certain way, mothers him in the absence of his mother. But we're as integralists, that gets to be part of our story, and we need, not only do we need a framework, but we need a community of people that can have this fuller conversation. Because otherwise we don't realize and deepen our understanding. We need a guide like you. We need someone to name these things. We need the questions to get posed. And in that way, we grow our body, our emotional life. These other lines of development come along with this cognitive evolution.
Yes. So what happens here is we're engaging a relative self that's at second tier. So now our witness has a holistic, integrated structure through which to experience the world. So in its own direct immediate experience, it's unqualifiable. It's just that pure I amness before it is anything. It's prior to the Big Bang, prior to your parents, prior to manifestation. That's pure, unqualifiable thusness. But then there's manifestation. There's the whole realm of form. And that form develops through stages and levels. It's evolutionary. And that's what the people that were just using introspection, including the Buddhists, that part is what got missed in the great meditation systems. So even though Buddhism is a very profound system of thought, particularly for its time, has this notion of dependent origination, it doesn't understand that that notion itself evolves through several stages. And that you can think that way at an egocentric, ethnocentric, world-centric, cosmocentric stages. Mm-hmm. And in each case, what you're including as elements that are interdependently originated will become fuller and fuller and fuller and fuller. And more and more and more elements will be understood as dependently originating. But it's a pretty small slice of the pie at the early stages. And so that's why all these great systems waking up don't have any maps at all of the structures of growing up. Humanity didn't discover structures until about 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It discovered states about 50,000 years ago. And the great meditative systems are how to move through those states from a narrow egoic waking state all the way to a non-dual, triatita, union of emptiness and form state. But that emptiness could be one with magic form, mythic form,
rational form, pluralistic form, integral form, and it's essentially going to interpret itself differently. Even though that direct, pure emptiness is itself not interpreted, it's unqualifiable, and it's directly and immediately known. It just can't be said without getting into form.
So there you have it. That's about 27 minutes of what was about an hour and 15-minute discussion. And, you know, the elements are of that conversation that we just heard, talking about pattern recognition and false pattern recognition. And instead of seeing the either-or, starting to see how the patterns are relatively true. And, you know, just what this huge awakening to this third-person perspective of pattern recognition, how much influence that's had on our lives, and, you know, particularly on the technological part of our lives. And then, you know, as Terry pointed out, seeing that subject becoming object as a method of truth starts to become an object in consciousness. So we're seeing the process of truth coming into being. As Ken says, you can no longer just make good arguments. We're actually starting to see the process of truth at work. And these stages, you know, this is the territory. And then finally talking about how our identity shifts when we start to see truth as actually a set of truths that are becoming more complex and disclosing more. So having said all that, I'd like to give both Terry and Jeff an opportunity for some commentary, and then we'd love to open it up to your questions. You've been great listeners hanging in on the call. So Jeff, do you want to lead out? What are you listening to tonight that's interesting you?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Am I good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it's well, first of all, the idea of pattern recognition is just, you know, I think of this week. I'm trying to watch soccer, you know, and good Lord, I'm so pathetic. It's like I'm watching an anthill. You know, I have no idea of the patterns, and I know there's, like, deep patterns there. So this pattern recognition, yet when it comes to capital R reality, I actually think I have a pretty good grasp. And this next thing, you know, I mean, I really, this integral move from postmodernity, this postmodern move where we begin to integrate the whole sort of thing in a new way, is very compelling to me. And what's new to me in the last year, and I've been at this for 10 or more, I've been at this for 20, and 10 by myself and 10 with other people. But what's new for me and what's really getting embodied and lived is this idea of first and second person going all the way down, so to speak. That reality, the scientific view of the universe, which is presented in Cosmos, this, you know, awe-inspiring evolution or, you know, consequence of the Big Bang and all of its splendor, I got that. What I hadn't really gotten with this idea that this thing that I see as Jeff, my Jeffness, actually is present in my little black dog laying next to me in her Stella-ness, that she has an interior, individual interior that is of the same stuff as mine, perhaps less complex, I hope, but nevertheless the same stuff. And that goes down to snails, and that goes down to molecules, and that goes down to atoms. And I just see that there's a I just want to read one paragraph of something I actually posted about that I thought was just so interesting, because we see the scientific worldview as being so sort of having colonized the first and second person, but yet they're sort of trying to make progress in their own way. And there's this the philosopher David Graeber, who's an anthropologist at the London School of Economics. And he's talking about this idea of, as far as he can tell, atoms, we have to take into account that atoms want to play, P-L-A-Y, play. And this is really sort of cutting edge among the younger generation of sort of renegade philosophers. And he addresses the great physicist Richard Feynman, has this famous observation that when it comes to explaining the unpredictable path of electrons, as Feynman said, apparently an electron can do anything it likes. And that sort of has this interiority that is sort of implicit there. And so Graeber writes, if one wants a consistently materialistic explanation of the world, because that's all you got in modern scientific materialism, if one wants a consistently materialistic explanation of the world, that is, if one does not wish to treat the mind as some supernatural entity imposed on the material world, then it makes sense that something at least a little like intentionality, something at least a little like experience, something at least a little like freedom would have to exist on every level of physical reality as well. And I think that's right. But at that point, you're into the interiors, this idea of interiority, of experience, of freedom, of intentionality. That's really something. So I'm seeing this happen in the culture as we sort of even, you know, people who've never heard of Integral or Ken Wilber or any of us. There's something about this that's coming online. And I just want to close with just a quick observation that what this does for me, when I see that atoms themselves want to play, and I see that they have, that this interiority of mine, this Jeffness, which I used to think was just here to torture me, actually is supposed to be here and is indeed a part of my being, and that other beings, just as other atoms are attracted to other atoms, they just can't keep their hands off each other, and they create molecules. That other people are supposed to be here too, and they're actually not just here to annoy me. So this has been great realization for me just in the last year. And I guess I'll stop there.
Wow. Amazing. How about
that
you,
was
Terry?
Beautiful, Jeff.
Yeah. Totally.
Well, you know, I'm there are a lot of different places to reflect here. You know, one of them is that in our integral discourse, part of what we are becoming is friendly to Eros all up and down the ladder. So there's a delight that Ken has in appreciating the things that David Lloyd discovered about how Darwin was not just rooted only in an orange perspective, but was actually going towards some decidedly green and higher values. And that recognition kind of helps break the orthodoxy of that scientific materialism, and we appreciate that. We don't need for Darwin to be already at turquoise in order for us to appreciate the Eros expressed in that higher cognition. And we can all appreciate the pattern recognition intelligence of looking at the cosmos and the development of our view of this vastness of our universe and the telling of the story of big history, even from a completely materialistic point of view, as progress within orange, of orange beginning to break in the lower vision logic and giving us a more comprehensive vision of the cosmos. And then we turn our attention on our own processes, and we can see how Descartes tried to take a perspective on his own perspective taking and find an objectivity, a place that he could stand like Archimedes and move the world. And out of that, he worked out the deal, really, through which science was able to coexist with religion for the first few hundred years of the development of modernity and how important that was. And yet here we are appreciating and really loving this really well-done television show, but also noticing how the existing consensus requires it to be decidedly materialistic and to teach almost in a traditionalist way. All these guys had wrong pattern recognition until Newton, and then Newton got it right. And teaching us the way to see it, the right way, the wrong way, just like you would learn the catechism in church, the truth and the falsehood. And for us to enter into this with an appreciative friendliness for the partial truths that are embodied and the relative eros, the relative breaking free, the more adequate pattern recognition that's being activated up and down the spiral. This is kind of fun, and it's fun to be engaging with popular culture that way.
It's
one of the things that you pointed to especially, Di, and I think maybe you'll elaborate on more, but that is amusing to me, is that even though this is a catechism by Neil deGrasse Tyson in understanding the right way to take third-person perspective, they're smart enough about how to tell stories that they do it by telling the stories of the human beings and the conflicts and the relationships and the alliances and the pettiness and the whole dynamic, and that's what makes the episode come alive. So even when we're falling in love with a third-person perspective, we're having to include our second person just to find our feeling connection to the whole thing, which acknowledges the dimension of our first person, you know, what constitutes us. And I feel friendly to that, too, and that there's something in the sweep of all this that tickles a whole lot of different aspects of an integral cognition, and it feels really cool.
Mm-hmm, I should say. Yeah, I'll just say something briefly because then I'd love to hear from people on the call. But yeah, I think a couple things about, you know, just the, you know, what we call the lower left and the lower right, in the sense that, you know, that his, Isaac Newton's first person was relatively, from what we could tell, you know, he was in pain and had that experience of being abandoned. And then, you know, his relationships were quite truncated, and then he had this really quite intense conflict, and it looks, as I said, he was a little bit mothered or mentored by, or at least advocated for by Haley, and, you know, helping him, supporting him, bringing that work in. So just that support actually allowed him to bring his work forward, and that, you know, the whatever scientific truths emerge to some degree are dependent on the recognition of culture to validate, support, and to some degree these days provide the research money, and that we're in those kind of, that we kind of are in these crazy culture wars, you know, where when you talk about the, you know, the religiosity really of cosmos itself and of the host in a certain way, that this is the point of view. And then you think about people throughout the states who are, you know, more grounded at a mystic meme level of development, who truly doubt a lot of science and doubt the science of global warming or climate change and doubt the science of all kinds of things. And then it allows me, as Jeff said, to be a little bit more at home with how uncomfortable that is. And at the same time, I'm also given a lot of hope by the fact that it means that we are evolving second person as well, and that, you know, I'm interested in conflict, I'm interested in how people evolve working on conflict, and I genuinely see that there is a trajectory where people are able to do more and more complex tasks in relationship to a dispute, including how do you work with this third person empiric data? What would the evolved conversation between these two great scientists and this one particularly genius scientist, what would the evolved conversation be that could hold both points of view and actually use the empiric evidence in a way that actually supported that? So it's exciting for me to think that we can evolve in the second person, and that we may get to a point where we actually can use the data in a way that has more immediate impact for the good of humanity. So those are just some of the things that I'm thinking about. We'd be really interested to hear from you if you have a question of one of the three of us. Ken's not live on the call, obviously. You're happy to ask. I mean, we'd be happy to hear it. And if you have a comment, it would be great to hear your comment. I'm going to kind of track a little bit and try and help people limit their comments to about 2 minutes. If you do have one, just because we have so many people on the call, we want to hear from as many people as possible. So if you're interested in a question or comment, you can press 1 on your handheld, and we would love to hear your voice live over this virtual living room. So in the first person perspective, because I practice meditation, and I've been involved in Zen practice for so long, it's very comfortable for me to sit in the silence and wait till something emerges. Joseph Robinson. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Great to be on the call, everyone. And
yeah.
I really love Ken's input tonight. What occurred to me and what I was looking up online during the conversation was this whole idea of third tier. And recently, you know, becoming more and more aware of a deeper second tier. And I understand, too, that as we evolve in our states and minds and levels, that often when you step into another level or tier, you get a deeper perspective on the one you're about to exit or evolve through.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit about that a bit? And there seems to be some controversy on the web about if third tier exists with Beck and so forth.
Yeah, so give me your sentence, Joseph, if we can talk about it in more general terms, but specifically, what is your question?
Is
there third tier?
What does the living room say about third tier and what Ken said? And and then what does that mean for changing the center of gravity in our culture?
Okay, so we move from third, what is third tier, to second, what is it? What are the impacts of culture? And then what's the first person? How do I support myself in getting to third tier? I'm, of course, mostly interested in the first one.
Yeah. So I don't know what that territory looks like, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not, you know, to be honest, I'm not very familiar with it either, so I'd like to just open it up to Jeff or Terry.
Yeah, I could jump in on that one.
Please.
Ken has basically defined the third tier as transpersonal stages, where an awakening to a self, we begin to operate from a self-transcended self. And therefore, we're awake not just to gross waking state realities, but to subtle, non-ordinary realities and even causal realities. And so it's the structures that correspond to the stages of spiritual realization that he's referring to as third tier. And these are really beyond Don Beck's experience, and it's certainly not much in the way of data to describe these things. It's something that Ken understands because he's a pandit, an actual practitioner with some real awakening, that he ventures into this territory. But you're not going to find developmental psychologists able to, because they can't interview a sufficient data set of people who are operating at these levels so that it can be mapped. So at the level of the data that supports the different levels in first and second tier, third tier is speculative, and that's why it's challenged. That's my understanding. And then my sense is, and I've discussed this at some length with Ken, is that our awakening to higher state stages of consciousness through spiritual practice is what turbocharges our growth into higher stages, even higher stages in first and second tier, but especially into third tier. So the way one grows into third tier, or just into higher stages in general, wherever we are, is in part to practice and to awaken to higher states, and to be doing that in a spirit in which our own very way of making meaning is something that we're making object, we're regarding as a project that's always under construction. So we're always learning how, you know, we're getting feedback from the world about how we're making sense of things, and we're factoring that in and kind of being willing to make adaptations and shifts so that our very way of orienting is something we're looking at, and it remains dynamic. And when we operate that way, awakening into higher states of consciousness actually shifts the way we're making meaning of our experience.
And I would say it slightly differently, or in addition, I would say not just making our meaning making object, making our very self-identity object, like really looking at self-identity and really noticing all the times throughout the day when the self-sense disappears. And so who's functioning when there's no sense of self there? And to kind of start to really become a student of your own flow states and your student of absorption states and the student of ecstatic states, and then notice on the other side of the street when you get really pulled into more contracted states, like states of anger, jealousy, you know, mostly we call those mental afflictions, you know, what is it around identity that's actually being challenged there? What is it that the self-identity is responding to? And by liberating and starting to loosen that the whole texture of functioning kind of in this more as what Terry described as self-transcended way actually starts to feel like a possibility. Joseph, is that good? Is that satisfying?
Yeah, that is. And you know, my awareness is that the falling away of that contracted, you know, two-ness, you know, the separation, you know, felt very non-dual in second tier to me. I guess you know it when you get there to third tier, I guess.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. It's like the Supreme Court justice who said that about pornography. You know, I have a hard time describing it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. So let's see. We've got a few other questions. One here from Lynn Dirksen. I don't know how to say your last name, Lynn. How do you say it?
Well, that was a mistake. I'm sorry. I'm just listening in. Thank you for the call, though.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to hear your voice. All right, let's see. Let me look here and see who else has a question. Mark Schultz, question or comment. Go ahead, Mark. Where are you?
Hello. I didn't know I was, I had pressed the button.
Okay.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, actually, I'm in Salt Lake City. Hi.
You are? You and I are in the same city.
I know. I'm actually walking around Liberty Park right now.
Are you really? Well, we're
about
3 or 4 miles from each other. I'm up in the foothills.
Yeah. So, first of all, I just want to express my appreciation for all the work and dedication to the work for all three of you. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
That's nice. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess I want to stop here for a second. I was really fascinated by how you framed conflict, Diane, and what I do is I run an organization called the NBC Academy. We practice nonviolent communication. Excuse me. And I've been wondering about how to bring NBC to integral level. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but
I am. Yes, of course. In my work. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure how familiar everybody is. I think what I'd like to do, unless Terry or Jeff has a different idea, maybe since you're in Salt Lake, you and I could sit down and talk it over a cup of tea because it's a little bit involved.
Okay,
what
sure.
Do you think? Do you live here?
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay. Do you live in Salt Lake City?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
By Trolley Square, actually, so...
Okay.
I could get a hold of you. That'd be, if you're willing.
Yeah, great.
Wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just so you can go to my website, Diane Musho Hamilton, and get my email and shoot me an email, and we'll get together and talk that through. I would love to have that conversation because I actually have some ideas about it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I will do that.
That'd be great. Awesome. So one of the things, everybody, that we love about the Integral Living Room is it gives us an opportunity to network. So you saw some networking happening in real time there. And the Integral Network is really a wonderful community of people to be with. As I said before, you know, you end up having friends all over the world in all different kinds of inquiries. And I had a friend in South Africa who actually took my nephew into an integral recovery program in South Africa. He was having trouble with addiction. So it's really a fascinating and wonderful, really, really diverse community of people. It looks like Marjorie has a question. How about you, Marjorie, or a comment?
Hello. Yes, I'm so glad to be on the call. I have a question that I'm not sure how this fits into the discussion, but I just recently finished a course with Ken Wilber on the superhuman operating system. And I'm also taking a course with Barbara Marks Hubbard.
Great.
And I just finished a course with Jean Houston, and all of them have spoken about, you know, creating this new superhuman species. And they talk about this thread of consciousness that goes from the beginning of time all the way up through to infinity. And I'm just wondering, how do you all feel about that? Is there something that is pushing evolution from our ancestors, and that we are where we are at, and there's something from the future that is pulling us towards this new species? And I just wondered, how does this fit into the discussion that we have tonight about the series of the cosmos? Is there any connection?
Yeah, I'm sure all three of us have things to say about that. Jeff, would you like to go first?
I'd take a stab at it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, we want to see that the universe is alive, and that it's actually, when you look at all of evolution, the whole 13.8 billion years, human beings have shown up just in the last, 250,000 years. I mean, it's like if this was a 24-hour day, it'd be in the last second. So there's actually something going on. There is an interiority to evolution that, I mean, what we notice is that the Cosmos series doesn't really talk about the creative force or intentionality or enthusiasm, the ability to reflect on oneself. And one of the great things about integral theory is that we take that so seriously, and we see that not only do we do it, but so do atoms in their own way. And I just think that's astonishing. And for me, I want to think about, so really what does this teaching do for me? What maybe is the third tier expression of this? And when I realize that every molecule and every atom of my body has a consciousness and loves every other atom and molecule, is, relating, I almost can't stand it. I almost get that realization that these great sages of traditionalism and Hindus and Jewish and so forth, where, you look at the face of God and you just fry. Because it's just so magnificent. There's just so much going on. And it's actually not out there. It's in here, too. And so, that's sort of the transmission. And I think we actually need to do more spiritual practice around that sort of thing. I think that's one of the things we're working with. It's one of the things that we do at the Integral Living Room. And we're just pioneering this. We're trying to figure out what are the best practices. That's why I love the living room so much, is because it's not about us coming with some teaching. We're not actually going to teach you about the cosmos. We're going to use this as a jumping off point to talk about ourselves and each other and the world and how we relate. And, how can we actually move into these new stages, even, with these third tier. When I think of third tier, I'll just do one last 30 seconds. And for me, third tier is about identifying with the Jeff that doesn't die. So there's this Jeffness that is inhabited by, or is inhabiting this small Jeff, or this Jeff in space, in time and space. But that actually survives this Jeff's demise. And when I realize that, I don't always realize that. That's something I try to remember and getting better and better at, but it's not all the time by any means. But when I do, I'm less afraid of dying, and that's just magnificent. That's a core spiritual teaching, to make friends with death. And two, I just sort of am less afraid of living, actually. And wow. That's, again, I'm just scratching the surface of the, neutron star that this realization is. I guess I'll stop there.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you. Gene Houston refers to something called the entelechy, which is the innate knowingness of the acorn to become the oak tree and so forth. So I think maybe that's a little bit of what you were just speaking of, that there's something innate in you that knows that you are part of this big something.
Yeah, it's almost like I can't help but grow. It's like a rose can't help but bloom. I mean, it couldn't stop itself if it wanted to.
Yes.
You know, and it
unless it doesn't, if it doesn't have enough light or water, that's why we need culture. We
yeah,
need to be
enough.
In the right
good
conditions,
yeah.
Right?
Thank you, Di.
The right conditions to grow. That's why we need each other so much. That's why this forum is here. So, Terry, you want to take a swing at it?
I kind of feel like what everybody said is pretty full. The thing that I might point out is that word entelechy. It's interesting. We have a lot of words from Greek for the same thing: eros, entelechy. Telos even refers to the same thing, the telos being the end point or the omega point toward which the entelechy or the eros is drawing us.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that they're each a nuanced expression of something a little different, the entelechy kind of pointing to the pattern energy that's going forward, the eros to the raw energy, the telos to the end point. And it shows what a core and key principle it is that we have one ancient language with three different words to express aspects of it, and how interesting that we have a current dogma in the scientific materialist world that necessarily has to kind of a priori exclude it from reality. That's the only thing I have to add to what's already been said.
A couple of things that I would add just in terms of, you know, my including this evolutionary perspective, certainly in the practice of Zen, but just also in my personal life. The first would be that it's very affirming to my identity as a learner. And this notion that, you know, by participating in learning, I'm participating in the movement of the cosmos. And that creativity is a natural birthright of mine. That I'm naturally creative in the same way the cosmos is, and that just as the cosmos in every moment, you know, we talk about the creative advance into novelty, there's this tension between something new, something preserved from the past, and perhaps something going out of existence. The destructive force is also present. And that for me, the preservation principle is really around practice. What is it I want to practice? Who are the people I want to practice with and why? What is it exactly that I'm wanting to preserve and for what reason? And then how does that creativity and that learning get to be included in the practice so that when we're practicing second-person dialogue or we're practicing meditation together, I have very specific reasons for wanting to preserve that just as the cosmos does. So I have this sensation that I'm at home in reality, that reality is my home, and my job is really to occupy as fully as I can this moment in time for as long as I'm here. To the fullest extent that I can be. This is the small self speaking. Now, when awareness opens up and there's that I become identified with all that is, then that's even less of a concern. But from a unique self perspective or this unique Jeffness that Jeff's talking about, that really my obligation is to be as fully alive as possible, participating and a participant in this creativity and in this yearning and in this unfolding. And that the last thing I would say before I close is just that also really excites me in terms of not knowing. Because if I look at how much time has expanded in my awareness, that my whole relationship to time, I used to think the spiritual traditions weren't any good because we still hadn't learned how to love our neighbor. But when I realized that the cosmos is founded on love and that human beings are, you know, as Jeff pointed out, 250,000 years old, and that those teachings as texts and as practices have only been around at the very most, the big teachings for 10,000 years, we're doing well. It just flips my whole perspective. And it gives me a way not to have to know. So I can participate watching the Cosmos series. I can see my first-person perspective. I can watch the second-person conversation and have interest there. I can watch Neil deGrasse Tyson's enthusiasm and yet how he prefers to call Bruno, one of the early Italian mystics, rather than a mystic, it's almost like he calls him lucky, as opposed to that he had a profound intuitive capacity. But, you know, I get to participate in that experience as fully as possible. And I don't have to know it. That knowing is a pleasure. Knowing is an an aesthetic opportunity. And just as Ken said, that this level of knowing is going to be replaced by a greater level of knowing, by another level of knowing, and that just allows me to relax with the mystery.
Beautiful, Doug.
Hallelujah, sister.
Yeah, you said it. Sing it. Sense that our knowing is provisional, and even our way of knowing is provisional.
It's provisional, absolutely, and changing, absolutely.
To be freed up from that false ego of knowledge presences us to the mystery and to the dynamism of the mystery unfolding itself before our eyes through us as us, and
absolutely.
As us individually and as us together.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah.
And you can feel that when we're able to have these conversations, we say in the Integral Living Room that Rumi said that there are three ways to worship God. And the first is meditation, the second is prayer, and the third is conversation. So we actually get excited talking to one another, and that excitement is the expression of Eros itself, that we're passionate, that we're turned on, that we're awake and alive to reality. And what could be better than that? So having said that, I'd like to turn it back to Jeff just to give us his concluding remarks and then maybe bring us to a close.
Yeah, cool, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I really do think there's a practice in here. This is what we're doing as people who are self-identified as being at the stage of development where we're actually ready and willing to move beyond scientific materialism. Not beyond it in a way that negates it, but beyond it in a way that completely appreciates and loves it and includes it in a bigger system that sees that the whole cosmos, this is where we move from cosmos with a C, which is third person, to cosmos with a K. It's what you were talking about a minute ago, Terry, these Greek words to sort of add something to the party. And cosmos with a K means that we see that there's an intelligence, there's a first-person consciousness that has also been developing from the original Big Bang, and that we contain the latest evolute, the most complex, capable, self-reflective, other-reflective system of consciousness that has ever been, that we know of at least, emerged in the cosmos. We're cutting that a new groove. And that there's a dimension of the cosmos that is in second person. That is, there is a relationship of one thing to the other. And there's a choice, and there's an attraction, and there's an engagement, and there's a love. We actually have the urge to merge, and we do. We just can't help ourselves. And that's all the way down to the first moment of the Big Bang. It was probably there before the Big Bang. And that changes everything. It really does. This is a new view of reality that we don't want to just see in third person through an integral map, but we want to inhabit and feel. And that does require us getting together. Or, you know, on the phone, in the virtual world, there's an amazing integral community that's formed in the last 10 years. That is, there's sort of a new era of coherence, actually, in the integral community, the European conference, a lot of people getting together. The virtual world is really happening, and we're doing it tonight. And then there's also what we do at the Integral Center, which is remarkable in its own way. There's just nothing like actually getting together and hanging out with other integralists in a way that just privileges seeing and being seen. As we together engage these big questions, the questions actually that human beings have always asked, these, you know, the first questions, who am I and what am I doing here? What is this?
Who am I, who are you, and what is it?
Exactly. I always love, you know, Trumpa's explanation that the first syllable of the universe that arose, the original primal sound is, you know. So, you know, from there, here we are. So, anyway, I guess.
Hey, Terry. Terry, remind us about the Integral Living Room. Can you take a minute?
Yeah. Let me.
Thank you, Jeff.
Say that all of what we're talking about is our enthusiasm for what we get to do when we get together. There's just been something that I'm just so privileged to participate in, that somehow a combination of warmth and wit and spiritual awakening and vulnerability and presence and risk-taking and humor and silliness and fun comes together in certain integral gatherings. And I feel like we've managed to hit a kind of sweet spot of public improvisation as performance art, intimacy, just hanging out, that ends up taking the form of this thing we're calling the Integral Living Room. And we're really excited to invite everybody to join us October 9th through 12th in Boulder, Colorado. And go to integralllivingroom.com, and you're still able to register for the discounted price. And the first two living rooms sold out, so we encourage you to think about it, look at your calendar, and consider joining us. It is a total blast. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for being here with us. It was fun to hear a few of your comments and questions, and it was exciting to have so many of us, over 100 of us, gathered here. So long until next time. We'll be having another call coming up next month. I have to tell you the date, even. You'll be getting something in your inbox about.
I think it's July 31st. It's at the
okay.
end of the month.
Very good. Yes. Okay.
If we didn't
so
get to your
everybody.
Questions, everybody, we're sorry about that. And Brett Walker, do you want to open up the mics? Thank you so much, everyone, for taking time to be on the call.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Bye. So long, everyone.
Rock.
Okay.